Hello, and thank you for downloading this episode of Radio Grimbald from RadioGrimbald.com. I am your host, Goldine Ogawa, and welcome to the 12th episode of Radio Grimbald. Hello again. It's good to be back. As you probably know, the show's been on a bit of a break the past week, which doesn't mean I've been on break. Oh, no. Somehow, I've managed to be just as busy as always, getting stories published. It's a lot more work when you do it yourself, you know. Editing the podcast. Oh, and I've started a new graphic novel series. It won't be available to read for at least a year, but I'm going to be working my behind off on it during that time. It's going to be in color, too, which is a special kind of self-torture I won't go into right now, but the pictures look pretty, and that's what counts. Right? Right. Why do I do this to myself? Last week was especially busy because I was working on a different project, which I can't really tell you about until things are a bit more solid, but suffice to say, it involved reading a story that was actually written by someone else. The shock! But this week, and this is the important bit, put down your coffee, I'm reading The Twisted Unicorn, the seventh and one of my favorite stories from The Adventures of Bo Ragnar Phelps. For those of you new to Radio Grimbald, The Adventures of Bo Ragnar Phelps is a series of short stories about the magician Bo Ragnar Phelps. And on this season of Radio Grimbald, I've been reading from the first volume of these stories. Don't worry, they're all self-contained, so it doesn't really matter if you jump in the middle. But if you're curious about the series, you can find the episodes neatly listed in chronological order on the website at radiogrimbald.com under the Episode Directory tab. And as always, before we begin, it is my duty to inform you that this, as with many of my stories, takes place in a completely fictional fantasy land, and as such, the places, names, accents, and history found therein may differ to a greater or lesser degree from the ones you find in this world. And that being said, there isn't really anything else to say, except that Radio Grimbald is proud to present The Twisted Unicorn. Copyright 2012 by Goldine Ogawa. Winter of 2283 in Kyland, and the snow came, heavier and thicker than ever in my memory. It blanketed the streets and roofs of Redling and left deep drifts in the alleys. Phelps, on the first clear morning after two straight weeks of snowstorms, went out with the intention of performing his traditional run around the park, but found it to be utterly impossible because of the snow. He came stomping back up and threw himself onto the sofa in the sitting room, where he fell into a deep sulk. There I found him when I eventually rose, his dark mood an odd contrast to the bright and glittering world beyond the windows. "The elves could walk on snow," he said petulantly while I gasped and admired the view. "Unfortunately, I was never inspired to learn that skill, and now my past indifference is repaying my present self with frustration and regret."
"It does appear to be quite impassable," I conceded upon closer inspection. This was made rather difficult by the heaps of snow piled on the window-sill, but by standing on my toes I was able to peer down into the street, where I saw our neighbours now discovering what my guardian had before, as they pushed their doors open and were greeted by walls of snow tumbling inside.
"The snow itself is not impassable," Phelps informed me. "There are means too numerous to count for getting over, through, and under it, but running, that mode of transportation I had intended, is not one of them."
He glared miserably at the ceiling. "Someone appears to be trying," I remarked from the window. For indeed there had just come into view at the end of the street a dark figure forcing his way through the snow.
A futile endeavour,
Phelps proclaimed. He appears to be making significant progress, I informed my guardian. A most determined fellow, I must say. Why? I believe he is coming here. At that, Phelps roused himself to join me at the window, where we both looked down into the street at the man who was currently struggling towards our door through the snow. He was a wide, heavy-set man in a constable's uniform with an official constable's cape thrown over his shoulder and fastened in the front with gold buttons. As we watched, he disappeared behind the snow piled on the sill, but a moment later we heard the sound of his fist upon our door and the muffled grumble of his voice as he was greeted by our housekeeper, Mrs. Bryce.
"Well, well," murmured Phelps. "Perhaps this day will hold some interest after all."
We had just arranged ourselves in relaxed attitudes, myself in a chair with a book open, and Phelps with his legs stretched out across the sofa, when Mrs. Bryce opened the door. But she had no sooner opened her mouth to speak than she was shouldered aside, and the man we had seen in the street burst in.
"Mr. Boragler Phelps,"
he said, his voice urgent and gruff.
"Can I help you?"
Phelps replied languidly.
"You are Boragner Phelps, the one they call the Purple Magician, he who has solved cases of magical mystery across two continents?"
I glanced at my guardian in surprise. I had no idea his practice ranged so far from home. For answer, Phelps merely smiled and lifted the edge of his lilac dressing gown, revealing his plum-coloured waistcoat.
"The same,"
said he.
"And this is my ward, Miss Corianne Birch, who is kind enough to assist me in some of my cases."
The constable spared me only a fleeting glance. He marched across the room, leaving a light trail of snow from his boots and cape, and addressed Phelps.
"I must offer my apologies, Mr. Phelps,"
he said, clearing his throat and rocking forward on the balls of his feet like a nervous schoolboy.
"To call on you at such an hour, most intrusive, terrible manners. But we are in a rather delicate spot of trouble at Massford Park, and your expertise would be invaluable to all parties concerned."
"Massford Park,"
Phelps said, rising from his reclining position.
"That is the Earl of Glastonbury's residence, is it not?"
"Indeed it is, sir,"
replied the constable.
"And it is in the Earl's interest that I am here, for it is a bad business. His son was murdered last night."
At this, Phelps sat up all the way, put his feet on the floor, and fixed the man with a piercing gaze.
"Murdered?
How?" "Well, that's just the thing, sir,"
said the constable.
"We're not sure exactly how. We know how he died, that is fairly obvious. But it's the circumstances that have us all baffled. The Earl is abroad, and has wired to say he wants our investigation completed with all speed, but we are absolutely stymied. No hint, no clue, no motive, nothing. I said to my inspectrix, I told her, we need a miracle to pull the truth from this one, and she says to me, 'Cullens, why don't you find us a miracle worker then?' So here I am, sir, to ask your help."
"Your superior asked for me in particular,"
Phelps said with some surprise. The constable shifted on his feet, and more snow slid off his shoulder to the floor, where it began to melt into the carpet.
"No, not exactly," said he. "But you were the only man in the country, let alone Redling, that I could think of."
"Indeed. That is most flattering, though I am afraid I may be less miraculous than you expect. I have no inspiration for solving criminal mysteries, and unless the problem is a magical one, I can promise little help."
"Oh, but that is already more help than we have," the constable said. "We have had the sweepers out, but even they have proved useless so far, and,"
his voice dropped confidentially,
"I have never held much faith in them, and my inspectrix none at all."
Phelps cocked an eyebrow, a smile tugging at the side of his mouth. I knew that his feelings towards the sweepers, the official magical crime inspectors, were less than cordial, and I fancied Constable Cullens's chances of enlisting my guardian's help had just increased.
"Explain to me,"
Phelps commanded,
"how the unfortunate lord met his demise."
"Gladly," said the constable. "But I thought you might wish to make all haste to the scene itself, for as I was leaving, there was talk of removing the body to the morgue, and I imagine an astute man such as yourself would want to examine the scene of the crime with every detail intact."
The constable trailed off, for at the mention of the morgue, Phelps had sprung up from the sofa and thrown off his dressing gown, leapt over to a crumpled heap of purple fabric lying on the floor, and shook it out until it became his best coat. Pulling it on, he strode up to the constable and gestured toward the door.
"I'm at your disposal, please. Lead the way. Corian, I hope you breakfasted already. This may take all morning. Don't bother with a hat, for goodness sakes. We are in a hurry."
But Constable Collins, who evidently had some sense of propriety, felt that we did have time for me to dress suitably, and so it was 10 minutes rather than 5 that found us outside, making our way forcibly through the snow.
"Where is Marsford Park?"
Phelps asked once we had gotten about 10 feet from our door.
"Up St. Landers Street, across from the Church of Radiance?"
"The very place,"
Constable Collins assured him.
"Good,"
said Phelps.
"Then in the meantime, my good man, tell me everything you know about the situation."
The constable huffed and puffed and forged through the snow until he was even with Phelps, who, despite his earlier moaning about not being able to walk upon snow, was doing an exceedingly efficient job of walking through it. His long, piercing strides easily outstripped the constable and myself, so we struggled to keep up.
"Who we got the call at 3:30 in the morning? At least the station did. I went on duty at 5 and was sent out in carriage, but I hear they had a devil of a difficult time getting through the snow. Not that it was snowing at the time, but..."
Here he was obliged to stop talking in order to put on a burst of speed to catch up with Phelps.
"It was about like this," he panted. "But the facts of the case, sir, are these. At midnight, the Earl's late son, Lord Oakbridge, retired to his room and shut himself in. At 3 in the morning, he apparently rang for his valet, but when the man came up to his room, he found the door locked, and nobody answered his knocks. From within, he heard what sounded to be someone overturning furniture, as if searching the room, then a crash of breaking glass, which he assumed to be the window, after which he fled downstairs to fetch their butler, who had all the keys. When they got the door open, they found the room in complete disarray, the main window broken, and Lord Oakbridge on the floor, stabbed twice in the chest and stone dead."
"Fascinating,"
said Phelps, who was not even breathing hard.
"Did the man have any enemies?"
"None that we can find, sir," panted the constable. "He was not active in the sort of field that earns men enemies. A rather retiring fellow, I've been told. His only passion was his collection of exotic magical animals, all of which he obtained through licensed and respectable sources. I know. Every animal in his menagerie has heaps of paperwork behind it, and that was the first thing we went after, thinking perhaps one of them had been stolen or smuggled, and he had fallen in with disreputable fellows as a result, but no. All clean and above board as you could wish. But it's not only the lack of motives that has us stumped, Mr. Phelps. It is also the nature of the murder. We cannot fathom how the murderer got in or out, for there's no trace of footprints nor any reports of strangers spotted by the staff or the family."
"In this world," Phelps mused, "there are myriad ways to keep people from seeing you and of covering your tracks. I'm familiar with nearly all of them. I am sure I will be able to discover something when we arrive."
"That is a great comfort to hear, Mr. Phelps," said the constable. "Great comfort indeed. But there was more to tell. For although the late Lord Oakbridge had no enemies, he did have a rival. Mr. Saxon Cove of Westill, who also collects magical animals. But theirs was more of a friendly rivalry, sir, as far as the staff have been able to tell us. Inspectrix Enstrid went to interview him this morning, the same time I left to fetch you, so I don't know any more than... Good gracious! Is this St. Landers Street already?"
"It is," announced Phelps. The constable and I gaped at one another silently behind his back, for it had felt like we had only laboured our way to the end of our own street, Yet when we came to the crossroads, we found ourselves on St. Landers Street, with the Church of Radiance in all its platinum spires and snow-covered glory, and behind us, not a glimpse of our own home, with its familiar houses and shops, but the bustling madness of uptown Redling, as ploughmen got to work and road diggers made trenches in the snow with shovels and rakes. The noise suddenly increased, and the walking became much easier with the snow gone all muddy and trampled from many carriages and feet.
"This way, I gather?"
Phelps said, jerking us out of our astonishment. He set off across the street towards a truly magnificent city house, whose beauty was marred solely by the small army of police officers, constables, and tweed-clad reporters clustered around its front door.
"Yes, sir!"
cried our constable, and together we hurried after my guardian, whose long legs had already taken him nearly to the front steps. There followed a moment of great confusion as Phelps pushed his way through the crowd, neatly avoiding police and reporters alike, while Cullens and I had to struggle in his wake, getting poked and prodded by official elbows and accosted by wide-eyed, notepad-carrying men. Eventually, Cullens puffed out his chest like a bullfrog and bellowed above the racket,
"Make way for the magician detective! Make way, I say!"
These words were punctuated by some well-placed shoving, and soon a small aisleway appeared in the thronging crowd, which we hurried up like mice. Phelps was waiting for us at the door, talking to a tall, pale man in black, whom I could only assume to be the first footman. There was a moment of awkwardness then, as the footman, hearing Cullens's cries, turned to find the person indicated as the magician detective was a mere girl clinging rather desperately to a constable's arm. He looked from me to Phelps, his sallow cheeks colouring a little.
"Forgive me,"
Cullens bobbed his head.
"Drastic measures, I'm sorry. Your ability of getting through crowds is astounding, sir. Truly astounding."
"Oh," said Phelps vaguely. "It is only the most elementary form of misdirection magic. Now, you were saying, Probert."
Probert, who it turned out was the late lord's unfortunate valet, opened the door and bade us step inside. He spoke in a hushed, quick voice and never looked Phelps in the eye. All this made me think him rather untrustworthy, but Phelps listened to him with great attention.
"And they are all gone,"
he said, obviously picking up where he had left off.
"Not a single one left. Their cages mangled, broken, and the windows blasted clean away."
"Steady on, what's this about?"
cried our constable.
"The late lord's menagerie," said Phelps. "I'm sorry to say it appears another catastrophe occurred while you were away."
"What of the menagerie?"
"Raided,"
said Probert, barely above a whisper.
"Destroyed."
He flapped his long hands in agitation. Cullens puffed his chest up in his bullfrog manner and demanded we investigate the menagerie at once. But Phelps insisted on being shown Lord Oakbridge's rooms,
"preferably while whatever is left of the poor fellow is still in them." "Probert can show you,"
Cullens said, and strode out of the hall in what I could only guess was the direction of the menagerie. Sighing, Phelps gestured to Probert, and the poor valet, looking extremely uncomfortable, reluctantly led on. It was a tall, grand house, and the lord's rooms were very near the top. They were exceptionally cold from the draught let in by the broken window, though it gave a fine view of the rooftops of Redling and the spire of the Church of Radiance, which today shone like an ivory spike amid the confusion of snow-covered chimneys. However, once the constable on guard had stood aside and Probert had shown us in, the view was the last thing on my mind, for lying amidst the broken tables and overturned chairs, laid out neatly on his back and looking quite out of place, was the late Lord Oakbridge. His face was white and stared blindly upwards with an expression of mixed horror and confusion. He was wearing what must have once been his evening clothes, though now they were ruined by the two gaping stab wounds in his chest. One was directly over his heart, and the other about 3 inches below it, and these had spilled his blood all down his front.
"Steady now, Corian,"
I heard Phelps say in my ear. I protested and tried to move away, except that it was then I found the only reason I was still standing was because Phelps had taken hold of my elbows and was more or less holding me up. Behind us, Probert coughed politely.
"Perhaps the young lady wishes to wait outside?" When I turned to look at him, I saw that he had gone greenish, and it occurred to me that, whoever you were, seeing someone who you knew and cared for dead was many times worse than seeing a stranger dead. That thought alone made me nearly accept his offer, if only to get him out of the room, but Phelps gave me a firm shake and said, "Thank you, but no. Pull yourself together, Corian. It is only a dead body. It won't hurt you." I did not find this particularly comforting, but I did grab onto the nearest piece of furniture, which happened to be a cabinet, and stared at the floor until I felt my mind clear and my limbs begin working properly once more. While I was collecting myself, I heard Phelps moving around the room, shuffling through spilled papers and turning over tables and chairs to look underneath them. At length he went to the broken window and thrust his head out. He pulled it back in almost at once and cast a puzzled look at the room. Looking over my shoulder at the valet, he said, "When did it stop snowing?"
"About 10 o'clock last night,"
Probert said, with an air of having answered this question many times before. Phelps frowned. Then he shrugged, as if letting the problem go, and turned instead to the body. This he examined carefully from head to toe, finally peering into the gaping wounds, as if he expected to find the secret hidden inside. I found I had to look away again.
"Had anything been stolen?"
he asked, getting to his feet and wiping his hands.
"Nothing, sir,"
said Probert, who was trying to hide in the door frame.
"As you can see, there has been considerable damage to the room. Some of his furniture broken, papers torn, that sort of thing. But there is nothing missing."
Phelps tutted to himself, as if this were very ill-mannered of the murderer to leave so few clues.
"Have you tried any divining spells?"
he asked. Probert opened his mouth to reply, but was cut off by a sharp voice out in the hall.
"We don't hold with that sort of hocus-pocus round here, sir,"
said a voice, and a moment later Probert was shouldered aside by a short, wiry woman in an inspector's uniform. She had a weathered face and a pile of faded brown hair tucked neatly under her cap, and a pair of hard grey eyes whose gaze she fixed on Phelps as though she were pinning a butterfly to a board. Phelps took no notice.
"Really?"
he said.
"What a pity. May I presume you are Inspectrix Enstrid?"
"You presume too much by being here, but you are correct,"
the inspectrix said, marching into the room. She only came up to his chest, so Phelps contrived to fold himself down and hitch his shoulders back to give the impression of looking up at her modestly. But the woman was not in any way mollified.
"I leave my charge alone for 2 hours, and what?"
she said in a piercing voice to the constable at the door.
"Nothing is done, and I have an overdressed sweeper here who..."
"Ah," said Phelps, holding up a hand as if to damn the inspectrix's words.
"There I'm afraid you are mistaken. I have nothing to do with that association. I assure you my interest here is entirely independent."
The inspectrix, clearly not appeased, bristled.
"Then I would ask you, sir, to take your independence elsewhere. I have already had more than enough of your kind's hocus-pocus. I do not need any more clouding up this mess."
To my astonishment, Phelps merely nodded most meekly and ducked around her sharp elbows to the door, beckoning me to follow. I made a short bow to the inspectrix, avoiding her pin-like gaze, and darted after my guardian.
"Well, it is certainly an untidy matter," Phelps said once we were in the hall. "The menagerie now, I think."
We were halfway down the tall house when we met Constable Cullens on the way up. He was red in the face and puffing rather as if he had been in a hurry.
"Oh, good, you're still here,"
said he, gasping a little.
"I just heard the inspectrix got back and wanted to warn you. She can be a trifle harsh."
"But we have already had the pleasure of Inspectrix Enstrid's acquaintance,"
Phelps said, and when he saw how the constable's face fell, he added cheerfully,
"A most competent woman, I am sure. Still, even the best of us need help sometimes. Now, would you be so good as to show us this menagerie?"
Cullens was more than happy to. He led us at a thundering pace down the stairs and then across the entrance hall to the back of the house, where a small door opened onto a long, narrow yard. It had a roof, and so was out of the snow, and had at one point been filled with cages of all shapes and sizes, stacked neatly along either side. But now the cages were scattered everywhere, and many of them were no longer cage-shaped at all. Phelps paused beside one that had been bent into a sort of U, and nudged at it thoughtfully with the toe of his boot.
"What was in here?"
he asked. Constable Cullens fished in his breast pocket and eventually came up with a long piece of paper. He handed it to Phelps.
"There's the complete list from his secretary. The numbers refer to which cage they were in, which some of the cages still have, if you look closely."
Phelps unfolded the paper and held it up to the sharp winter light that came glancing in off the snow beyond the yard.
103. A cockatrice,
he read, his eyebrows rising.
That's the cage over by the fore wall, Cullens informed him. The one which is ripped in half.
116. 7 phoenix sparrows, oh dear,
he said, locating the remains of cage 116. The thing appeared to have been torn to shreds. Making his way through the mess of bent and broken wire caging, not to mention the spilled bedding and several very unpleasant-looking deposits of animal detritus, Phelps proceeded to go through most of the list, during which time he discovered that the late Lord Oakbridge had owned, among other things, a Zardorian snapping turtle, 2 salamanders, a Corinthian serpent, and a luck rabbit. Phelps stopped at the cage that had held the luck rabbit. It was particularly mangled, and the metal had been darkened in places, as though burned. There was also an angry scorch mark on the floor, which had blackened the earth and still smelled faintly vile.
"Luck rabbits," said Phelps, stonily, "are intelligent. They think differently from us, but they are sapient. And they know and understand things we do not. To cage one, under any circumstances, as a pet or a prize."
He trailed off, frowning at the remnants of the cage.
"Do you think this was an act of mutiny?"
Cullens asked a little hesitantly.
"I've spoken at length to the staff and my men, and they all agree that no one has been in or out of this menagerie all morning. But that leaves the question, where did they all go?"
Phelps, still with a contemplative frown, shook his head.
"It does lend itself to ideas, but not to solutions,"
he said.
"It is most difficult, as you say, and I can find nothing here which is conclusive. No, not because I have no hypothesis, but because I have too many. Could one of his animals have escaped and killed him? Could these luck rabbits have brought about his demise? Could it be something as mundane as a man with a double-pronged knife?" "I doubt it was a man,"
Cullen said heavily.
"Remember there were no footprints on the fresh snow, and his rooms were at the top of the house. I've worked in the force for 10 years now, but I've never met a murderer who could fly."
"I have," Phelps said. Cullens sighed and looked unhappily at the ground.
"I suppose the only person who could really know what happened last night is poor Lord Oakbridge, and now he is gone, well, we cannot question him. Lady rest his soul."
Phelps's head shot up, and there was a light in his eyes once more. He laughed, one short ha, and clapped himself over the forehead.
"By the rings, I think you've got it. Yes, yes, of course. Oh, what a dunderhead I have been. We cannot simply ask Oakbridge,
but he can.
Yes, of course he can. The clergy will object, they always do, but in this case it must be worth it. Come, has the body been removed to the morgue already? Well, quickly then, we must have it."
So saying, he leapt nimbly through the wreckage of the menagerie to the little door into the house and shot inside, once more leaving Cullens and myself to follow as best we could. We were only just in time, for Inspectrix Enstrid was supervising another group of constables in carrying the body, now mercifully wrapped in cloth and strapped to a gurney, down the stairs.
Phelps leapt up them two at a time and met the group before they reached the first landing. When we arrived, he was speaking quickly and urgently to the inspectrix, who was herself red in the face with fury.
"Out of the question! Unheard of! Ridiculous!"
I heard her saying in short gasps as we arrived.
"Inspectrix," Phelps said gravely, "you yourself have said that you have no rational explanation for this mystery. Did your interview with Mr. Saxon Cove provide any insight?"
The inspectrix pressed her lips together until they were a thin line, but she said,
"No, no, it did not.
He knew nothing of the matter until we told him, and the man's collection is intact and untouched. No solution there."
Phelps nodded understandingly and went on. "Then, surely if all avenues of investigation have failed, what harm some experimenting?"
He spoke evenly in a low voice, but I got the feeling he was putting more into his words than simple sounds, for the inspectrix's face softened, and she looked around at her constables, who all had carefully blank expressions plastered on their faces, and seemed to realize that if she refused Phelps, there would be much talk of her unwillingness to pursue an opportunity. She scowled.
"I am to remain present at all times," she stated, her voice even harder than before. "And I will suffer no hocus-pocus."
"I assure you, madam, my specialist practices anything but," Phelps declared, and led the way down the stairs and out the front door, with the rest of us an odd funereal procession behind the body. Once outside, it appeared that the street plough had been through at last, and there was a solemn hearse waiting at the bottom of the steps. Probert was there to see us sadly off, as well as a gaggle of cold but interested children who peered at us with hungry eyes from behind lampposts and hedges. While the body was being loaded into the back, Phelps stepped up to the driver and gave him some new directions. I caught a glimpse of the inspectrix glowering at them as Cullens and I climbed into the cab, but she said nothing, even when we were all seated and trundling slowly through the snowy streets. I wanted to ask my guardian who this person was we were seeing, but I knew from experience that he would not be best pleased to be prodded for information. So I sat and waited out the bumpy, chilly ride until the coach came to a jarring halt and we were able to disembark. Stepping down from the hearse, I very nearly plunged myself waist-deep in snow, for this part of the road had only been ploughed with the most rudimentary attention, leaving deep drifts along the side. I sidestepped hastily and edged my way along the hearse, but Cullens and Enstrid were not so nimble as I gathered from their startled cries. Phelps, to my consternation, leapt clean over the drift and dashed up to the door of the nearest house, leaving deep blue tracks in his wake. It was a tall, narrow, grey house, wedged in between two other tall, grey houses with dark windows and water-stained paint. Above the peeling brown door hung a sign, not unlike the sign of an inn, only this one was circular, black, and showed a white snake curled around and eating its tail. It was an odd thing, but the sight of it filled me with more apprehension than any of the morning's events, as if what it stood for was something worse than a skewered bloody corpse in a cold room. "Come along!"
Phelps called cheerfully from the path, breaking my reverie.
"And bring the body!"
Ducking through the drift to keep out of the constable's way, I stumbled up the garden path to where Phelps was rapping smartly on the shabby door.
"With any luck, he will already be awake,"
Phelps muttered to me over his shoulder.
"The man is impossible to work with when he has just gotten up."
"What man?"
I asked, daring a chance at an explanation.
"Hide again,"
Phelps said, and went to give the door another sharp smack. But he had no need, for at that moment the door opened, and a figure emerged from the dark house to peer, blinking, into the snowy light. He looked from me to Phelps with a glazed expression, but then his eyes sharpened, and he threw himself across the threshold and embraced Phelps like a brother. If this were not surprising enough, Phelps laughed and embraced him back, while I stood and stared in astonishment. When they finally released one another, still chuckling, Phelps turned to me, patting the man on the shoulder, and said,
"Dear Corian,
This is Heidegen.
Heidegen was a pale man of middling height and age, wearing a tattered dressing gown. He had messy dark hair and a face that would have been rather handsome if it were not for the heavy bags beneath his eyes and the uneven stubble that decorated his chin. Amidst this stubble was a delicate mouth with a hint of a smile about it, a contrast to his eyes, which were a disturbingly pale blue and betrayed no emotion. I could feel those eyes sweeping their gaze over me, and I shivered.
"Dear Corian, is it?" he said, scratching at his chin. "And what do you like to be called?"
I felt my face heating up, and I blustered rather.
"It's Corian Birch, if you please."
Heidegen laughed. He had a surprisingly warm, friendly laugh, quite at odds with his off-putting appearance.
"Well, Phelps," he said, turning back to my guardian, "what have you brought me today?"
Phelps smiled significantly and beckoned to Cullens and Enstrid, who were helping the constables struggling through the drift with the body.
"A new patient for you," said he.
At once Heidegen's pale face flushed pink and his eyes went wide.
"How long dead?" he asked.
Phelps quickly checked his pocket watch and frowned.
"I would hazard approximately 13 hours.
"Splendid, splendid," Heidegen said,
rubbing his long yellow hands together.
"Any peculiarities?"
While Phelps was giving Heidegen a brief but detailed account of the events of the morning and previous night, the procession with the body, led by Cullens and Enstrid, made their way up the path. Cullens kept trying to peer around Heidegen's frayed elbows into the house beyond, while the inspectrix stared resolutely at the grey wall of the place, as though to deny the occupant his existence simply by ignoring him. But she was quite unable to ignore Heidegen when he darted forward between Phelps and myself and made to begin unwrapping the body right there. Phelps coughed. Heidegen paused, smiled sheepishly at Enstrid, who was giving him a withering glare, and laughed.
"Oh, forgive me. Terrible manners, I know. But it is so rare that I receive such an interesting subject. Please, come inside, all of you. We'll take him downstairs."
The inside of Heidegen's house was dim and shabby in an elegant sort of way. We followed its eccentric owner through the parlour, where there was a table with a truly prodigious pile of papers heaped upon it, and waited in the hall beyond while he took out a ring of old iron keys and unlocked the door at the end of it. This opened onto a flight of stone steps leading down into darkness, and from below came a sharp, peculiar smell that I did not entirely like. Seemingly heedless of the dark, Heidegen plunged down the stairs and was soon lost to sight, while the rest of us huddled in the hall, unwilling to follow. Then, from a distance below, we heard the striking of a match, and a dull orange light bloomed at the bottom of the stairs.
"Come, come,"
came Heidegen's voice, his cheery tone an odd contrast to the sinister environment. With none too few apprehensive looks, Enstrid and Cullens, followed by the men carrying the body, descended the stairs, with Phelps and I bringing up the rear. I heard him shut the door behind us sharply, cutting off the light of day, and I was forced to navigate the stairs by the dim light and dancing shadows cast by the men in front of me. More than once I nearly slipped, for the steps were wet. At the bottom we emerged into a low-ceilinged cavern of stone with water running freely down the walls. It dribbled and trickled before vanishing into a dark trough carved in the juncture of the floor and the wall. The only light came from a dim lamp hung in the centre of the ceiling, and by it I saw the dark outlines of three narrow passages leading off at right angles. There was just enough light that I could glimpse the shape of many doors, all shut, set into their stone walls. Beckoning to us, Heidegen led the way down the middle passage, which ended quite abruptly in a similar stone door. This door had no lock, but required a wheel-driven lever to pry it open. As I passed under the lintel, I saw the wall was at least a foot thick. Heidegen, who stood just inside waiting for us, saw me looking and smiled apologetically.
"It is an intimidating sight, to be sure," said he, "but necessary. The neighbours complained to me of the sounds otherwise. This did nothing to allay my nerves, already set on edge by the morbid atmosphere, and the room itself was not a comforting one. It was square and low, and lit not by torches or lamps, but by a basket of strange glowing crystals, which cast an ethereal green light that did nothing to penetrate the shadowy corners of the room. The walls were pigeonholed with drawers, and I saw such unsightly labels on their fronts as eyes and liver, and one near the bottom, hands. In the centre of the room, directly under the basket of glowing crystals, was a single stone slab, about chest high, 8 feet long, and 3 feet wide. There was a crack in it, run crosswise, so the two halves tilted ever so slightly away from each other, and there were strange runes and sigils carved along its sides. Upon closer inspection, I saw that these were not runes at all, but tiny hieroglyphs of moons, suns, mountains, and eagles. In looking from one to the other, I thought they were telling a story, but in a language and a form I could not understand. Along with the eagle, the figure of a lion repeated itself over and over in different forms and positions, as well as a strange human-like creature with an elaborate spiked headdress. All these symbols were regularly punctuated by the motif of a snake, curved into a circle and eating its tail. "Put the patient here," Heidegger said, indicating this strange table. The body was brought forward and laid out on the stone, and I saw that the crack in the table lay directly beneath its heart. But before I could see more, Heidegger dove in and began to unwrap it like a child on Chandarmas Day. Phelps took me gently by the elbow and led me away into a dark corner.
"What Heidegger does can be rather shocking to one not used to his methods," he informed me in a low voice. "You may wish to wait outside."
It is an odd paradox, but whenever I found myself uneasy of a subject, having Phelps assure me that there was nothing to be afraid of only made my fears worse. Yet when he showed concern for my nerves, which should have told me that something truly horrible was about to happen, I found myself strangely obstinate. So this unexpected show of care only served to harden my resolve and pique my curiosity. I whispered back, perhaps more fiercely than was necessary,
"Absolutely not. I shall be perfectly fine."
Phelps's eyes went very wide, but I think he was pleased by my defiance. Certainly he did not press the point, and allowed me to stand by his side as we approached the table. Here Heidegger stood by the head of the body, now unwrapped, and gazed down at it intently.
"My, what a handsome fellow," he said in conversational tones, and abruptly bent his head so that his nose was mere inches from the dead man's. He sniffed. Then he straightened and sighed, like a connoisseur of wine surveying a particularly fine vintage. "Most of us cannot appreciate the subtle grace of death," he said softly. "But there is a harsh beauty there. Would you not agree? The dead do not fail. They do not harm. They do not disappoint. And we are, one and all, united by it. Death is the great equalizer, for though in life we may be princes and kings, beggars and thieves, once dead, we are all dead alike, and must rest in eternity as equals."
He smiled widely at us all, as though we could not help but agree with this profound insight, but we merely stared back with varying degrees of horror and revulsion, save Phelps, who coughed politely and touched Heidegger's sleeve.
"Indeed," said my guardian, "but time is wasting, and there is information we need your aid to acquire."
"Yes, yes," said Heidegger, sighing. "You're not a medium, are you, Mr. Heidegger?" Enstrid asked, now very white and tight-lipped.
"Good gracious, no," said Heidegger, as close to being affronted as I had yet to see him.
"Mediums are mostly frauds, and the ones that aren't are quite insane."
Enthrid stared at him coldly, as though she felt the pot was calling the kettle black, but said nothing. Taking this as acquiescence, Heidegen began rolling up his sleeves so that his forearms were bare, and from within his robes he took out a small stone knife. "I must ask for quiet. Silence, preferably, until I give you leave," he said. "This does require some concentration." We all nodded silently and drew away from him a little, for the knife looked very sharp. The knife in his right hand, Heidegen stretched out his left arm. In the dim greenish light, it looked as pale as the underbelly of a fish, and on his wrist I could perceive many ridged and ragged scars. One of them looked newly healed, barely more than a scab. In one graceful motion, he brought the knife to his naked skin. I had to look away. When I looked back, Heidegen had put away the knife and was daubing splashes of blood from the gash in his left wrist onto the corpse's head. One daub went in the center of the forehead, one on the lid of each eye, one on the lips, and a small smear across each ear. When he had finished, Phelps wordlessly handed him a white linen bandage, which he took with a nod of thanks and wound briskly around his wrist. Then, gently gripping the corpse's chin, he tilted the face up and, using both hands now, pried the mouth open. Then he lowered his own head, and I had to look away again. I heard Enstrid make a gagging noise, and two of the constables let out cries of disgust. When I dared glance back, I was just in time to see Heidegen straighten up and wipe his mouth with the back of his hand, and I had to fight the urge to gag myself. Not seeming to notice the reaction of his audience, Heidegen gripped the sides of the table and barked out a series of strange words that made all the hairs on my arms stand up. The room seemed to shift under my feet. The shadows came alive, crawling and writhing on the walls, and the carvings on the table glowed faintly. And the corpse opened its eyes. They were the eyes of a dead man, unseeing, clouded, and one was half bloodshot. They rolled upwards and around. Then he opened his mouth, and a sound came out that was like a wheeze and a scream. I felt surprised it was not I who was screaming, and indeed I found myself with my mouth open, but no sound came out. Glancing around at my companions, I saw similar reactions on their faces, all save Phelps, who stared down at the waking corpse attentively.
"I give Phelps leave to speak," Heidegen said in a hoarse whisper. "Ask him all the questions you wish. He will speak the dead truth."
"Who killed you?"
Phelps asked promptly.
"I don't know,"
said the corpse in a voice dry and creaking. The words were a little muddled, as though the dead tongue and the dead lips had forgotten how to speak.
"What killed you?"
Phelps asked, undaunted.
"I don't know,"
the dead man repeated. Phelps seemed a little puzzled by this, but then his expression cleared and he said,
"Describe it."
"4 feet high, 4-legged, with cloven hooves, a lion's tail, a horse's mane, double-horned, thin as skin and bones, fur as white as snow, smelled of water under a bridge."
The corpse's voice was growing faint, and when I glanced at Heidegen, I saw his face had grown strained and pale, and his eyes were narrow, glinting slits.
"I can't hold him much longer," he whispered.
Phelps nodded, but it seemed he had gotten what he wanted already. He smiled and rubbed his hands together before leaning forward to speak directly into the corpse's ear.
"When did you acquire your luck, rabbit?"
The inspectrix let out a frustrated gasp, as though she had had a different question in mind. I saw Heidegger's eyes go wide for a moment and roll in her direction, but when she said nothing, he returned to staring at his charge. The corpse's words were even more muddled now, and slow, but still clear enough. It said,
2 days ago.
And your rival, Mr. Saxon Coe, does he have any?
A strangled cough, and then a whispered word.
Yes!
Phelps nodded triumphantly.
Thank you very much. You may let him go now, Heidegger.
Heidegger's left hand shot out, wiping away the daub of blood on the corpse's head, and he whispered a word that made the late squire twitch from head to foot, and then lie still. Heidegger inhaled deeply, heavily, as if he had held his breath for the entire interview. Then he sighed.
"You may speak now," said he.
"The luck rabbits!" Inspectrix Enstrid burst out. "I could have told you that easily."
Phelps shrugged.
"I am certain the luck rabbit was the key to his demise."
He glanced at Heidegger, who was leaning on the stone table, breathing rather heavily.
"You recognized his description?"
Heidegger nodded soberly.
"It was the Aki Morris."
"But I don't understand," Cullen said
as we made our way back up to the world above.
"What is an Aki Morris?"
Phelps and Heidegger, who were walking in front, glanced at each other. They both frowned in a way that suggested the answer was a difficult one.
"The Aki Morris is a conglomerate creature," Heidegger explained at length. "Rather like our dead friend said, it has a lion's tail, a horse's body, and goat's feet. In this regard, it resembles a common unicorn, save that the Aki Morris has 2 horns.
I remembered the 2 gaping wounds in Lord Oakbridge's chest and shuddered.
"There is only 1 Aki Morris at a time, not unlike the phoenix," Phelps added. "It walks the boundaries between worlds and can come and go as it pleases."
"So, it's mythical creatures, is it?"
Enstrid's voice rang up from behind us.
"It appears so,"
I heard Cullen's mutter, but she ignored him.
"Ah, no. The Aki Morris is not mythical,"
Heidegger said gently, stopping before the door and opening it.
"Pegasus is mythical. Sleipnir is mythical. The Aki Morris is merely fantastical, but it is perfectly real."
Enstrid snorted. After we had climbed back up to the world of the light and the living, Phelps, Heidegger and I stood aside to let the constables bearing the body get by. As she passed, I heard Enstrid mutter under her breath,
"There was a wasted endeavour. I shall be all afternoon catching up on paperwork."
"I should hardly call it wasted," Phelps said in tones of mild reproach. "After all, we know who the murderer is. From there it is easy to deduce how the act was committed. It also explains why there were no tracks. The Aki Morris is quite skilled at levitation and would never have touched the snow. As to the unusual wounds, they are consistent with the size and shape of its horns."
"Horns!"
cried the inspectrix. She turned, and for a moment I thought she would spit at my guardian's feet. But she merely gritted her teeth and continued.
"Levitation! Fantastical creatures! How is this useful to my investigation? Give me leads. Give me clues. Give me motives. I can make something of that. Instead, I have a muddled and inconclusive description from a dead man."
"Muddled, yes," Phelps conceded, "but not inconclusive. I think it is time we paid a visit to Mr. Saxon Cove. Oh, Inspectrix Enstrid,"
he added as we reached the door,
"I would be most obliged if you would accompany us."
The inspectrix shot him a withering glare and left. Phelps sighed and turned to Collins, who was lingering on the front steps, looking rather red in the face.
"The invitation extends to you," Phelps said. "I believe you would like to see the culmination of our little investigation."
"The
culmination,
Cullen said, his eyes widening.
Do you mean to say you think you can capture this Ekimaris?
As close as can be done,
Phelps said with a shrug.
But time is of the essence.
How so?
The Ekimaris is a guardian of sorts. Its calling is to protect others of its kind. It has a particular affinity for magical, if otherwise helpless, creatures. Like luck rabbits. Of all the specimens I saw listed in Lord Oakbridge's menagerie, only luck rabbits could have provoked the Ekimaris to act as it did. If Mr. Saxon Cove is in possession of any... He trailed off, suggestively.
I see your concern, sir,
Cullen said.
I'll ask the Inspectrix to send us a four-wheeler when she reaches headquarters.
I'm afraid I cannot waste time on a carriage,
Phelps said, shaking his head.
It would be much faster to walk. Do keep up, if you wish to come.
And so saying, he strode off down the garden path.
Not without me!
Heidegger cried from the doorway. Turning, I saw he had changed out of his dressing gown and into an imposing black overcoat with large shiny buttons down the front. He had pulled on a pair of worn leather boots, and a tartan tam-o'-shanter had been jammed hastily on his head. He slammed the door behind him, not bothering to lock it, and dashed down the path to us. I caught Phelps with a look of flabbergasted delight on his face before he schooled himself into an expression of calm indifference.
My dear Heidegger, he said, I have never known you to leave the house so easily before.
The out-of-doors is not my favourite environment, I'll grant you that,
Heidegger admitted, adjusting his bonnet.
But for the Ekimaris, I know it is of no great gravity to you, Phelps, but to me it is the chance of a lifetime. Now, would you like to do the spatial folding, or shall I?
"Spatial what now?"
Cullens asked, looking rather alarmed. Phelps gave Heidegger an exasperated look and walked down to the embankment of snow where the Inspectrix and the hearse were just leaving.
"I'll be happy to explain it all," Heidegger said agreeably. "But we really must keep up with him. Yes, there he goes now, or he will leave us behind."
We were obliged to walk in the street at first, for the sidewalks we would have usually employed for this purpose were piled with snow, which had only been carted away as we drew nearer the middle of town. Heidegger lived in a part of the city I had never seen before, but Phelps strode ahead without the slightest hesitation, and soon I began to see familiar church spires and buildings.
"Spatial folding is really just a modest transportation spell,"
Heidegger was explaining to Cullens with the careful eagerness of someone who enjoys a good audience.
One does it by taking the fabric of space and folding it thus.
Here he illustrated by taking the hem of his coat and creating a valley of cloth and then bringing the two sides of the valley together.
Suppose we are here, on this side of the fold. By bringing these two spaces together, we can walk directly from one to the other, and thus cover a great amount of distance with very little effort.
He smoothed his coat out again.
I suppose it is more of a wrinkle than a fold,
he admitted.
But somehow, wrinkling space does not sound the same. It is a lot of work, of course, and one has to be careful to smooth the fold out behind him. That is why Phelps is walking so slowly, comparatively slowly. But it has the advantage of being able to transport many people with no added effort, though there is a limit to how big a fold you can make before things start, going wrong.
Oh, is this West Hill Gardens already?
Phelps, you really have gotten very good at this.
Phelps coughed modestly and turned to Cullens.
Whereabout in West Hill does this Mr. Saxon Cove live?
Cullens, who seemed to be glad of the change of subject, pointed the way, and together we walked down the wide avenue of grand houses until we came to one set back from the road with a lovely snow-covered garden in front. The door was opened almost immediately by an impassive footman who seemed not at all surprised to see us there, though I saw his eyes widen a fraction at the sight of Heidegger's bonnet. Still, he ushered us in with great politeness, took the men's hats and my coat, and began to explain in the driest possible tone how Mr. Saxon Cove had already spoken to the authorities on the subject of the late Lord Oakbridge and was not seeing visitors this afternoon. From upstairs somewhere, there came a muffled crash. Almost as one, Phelps and Heidegen turned their heads upwards, staring intently at the ceiling. Then they looked at each other. "It's already here!" Phelps cried, and took off for the nearest staircase, Heidegen on his heels. Not wanting to be left behind, I grabbed at my skirts, most unladylike, but I felt the circumstances allowed it, and ran after them as quick as my feet could carry me. I heard startled noises from behind as Cullens caught on and pushed the footman aside, and then we were all pounding up the stairs. I heard the footman shouting something about the gentleman having received a new addition to his collection this morning and had asked not to be disturbed, and it occurred to me that if this were true we would all look like great fools. But Phelps paid him no heed, and from up ahead I heard Heidegen cry, "I feel it! To the left, my friend!" As if guided by some invisible sign, Phelps dove left at the top of the stairs and wove his way down a hall cluttered with little tables bearing busts of famous persons, Heidegen trailing in his wake. Cullens and I followed as best we could, avoiding the tables with some difficulty, while the footman clambered behind us. The hall ended in a door, which was nearly blown off its hinges as Phelps approached, and he threw himself through it.
"Have a care! Remember, it is very fast!"
Heidegen called, and then he too was through the door. I arrived in the doorway in the midst of the crashing sound of furniture toppling, Cullens must have collided with a table, and the cracking, snapping sound of furniture being trodden on by four hooved feet. For a moment the scene before me was frozen in perfect clarity. A portly gentleman of mature years was sprawled on the floor, his face red and sweaty, but otherwise unharmed. Heidegen stood protectively over him, facing across the room to where Phelps, with his arms thrown wide, herded the author of the destruction into a corner. It was, to say the least, a most unusual-looking creature. Though easily as tall as a horse, it appeared much smaller due to its extreme thinness. It seemed mostly long, spindly legs, with a small, emaciated body on top. Its whip-like lion's tail was thrashing between its legs, and it had lowered its great head menacingly. This head appeared to be that of a horse, save for the two horns protruding from its forehead, one between and just below its ears, and one between its eyes. These were long, jagged things, wickedly sharp and, unlike the rest of it, which was a brilliant white, crusted with a brown substance, not unlike dried blood. Then the creature sprang. Phelps did not budge. He caught the creature's horns in his bare hands and braced himself. The Echimaurus seemed confused by this action and ceased to charge. It stilled, its head slightly bowed. Phelps, too, leaned his head forward, and they appeared to be speaking to one another, though I could hear nothing, and Phelps did not let go of the horns. Everyone stood as if frozen. Even Cullens and the unfortunate footman behind me in the hall made not a sound. Then Phelps released the Echimaurus. He took a step back and bowed low to it, and the Echimaurus bowed its head back. It shook out its snowy mane and looked around at us with deep, glistening black eyes. It twitched an ear, not unlike a horse unsure of its surroundings, and stamped a cloven hoof.
"Yes, yes, in a moment,"
Phelps said, as if answering an unspoken question. Holding his hands carefully away from himself, he turned to Mr. Saxon Cove, whom Heidegen was just helping to his feet. Huffing, rather, the man pulled his waistcoat straight and smoothed his hair.
"Dreadful dilemma,"
he was muttering.
"Awfully kind of you gents, much obliged. Sorry the creature got out. Spivins, bring a halter!"
In the hall behind me, I heard the footman making a discreet exit. Immediately, the Echimaurus's head snapped around, and it pulled its lips back into a disturbingly human sneer. Worse, I saw it had teeth as sharp and jagged as its horns.
"A halter,"
Phelps said blankly.
"Mr. Saxon Cove, do you take me for a blind dunce? This is not your creature at all.
As it is, I have only managed to convince it not to kill us on the condition that you release certain members of your collection. If you do not cooperate, then I am afraid we are all done for."
He spoke lightly, but his face was grim, and behind him, as if to enforce what he had just said, the Echimarus growled like an angry wolf. Mr. Saxon Cove, now very red in the face indeed, sputtered angrily.
"Who are you? You've no business. This is preposterous."
But Phelps held up his hands to stop him saying more, and I could see they were red with blood from several gashes across his palms. One on his left hand, the one that had grasped the Echimarus's larger lower horn, had a cut that looked particularly deep.
"I am Boragnar Phelps, and all things magical are my business," Phelps said. "Now, as I have already been to some pains on your behalf, I would appreciate it if I did not have to go any further. Please, take us to your menagerie."
The man looked as though he were going to continue making difficulties, but Cullens, showing surprising insight, stepped past me into the room and addressed the company.
"Mr. Saxon Cove," he said, nodding,
and then to the Echimarus he bowed, not unlike Phelps had.
Echimarus, sir or madam, pardon my intrusion, but to see justice done, I must know, has any theft been committed here? Is Mr. Echimarus seeking a compensation from Mr. Saxon Cove in the matter of stolen property or artifacts? Or was this an unprovoked assault?"
The Echimarus snorted and flicked its ears, and Phelps had to lay a hand, very gingerly, upon its nose. He shut his eyes and bowed his head for a moment, and then said,
"The Echimarus demands the freedom of its kin, wrongfully imprisoned against their will." "Wrongfully?"
snapped Mr. Saxon Cove.
"After I bought and paid for with papers to prove this, it wrongful imprisonment, is it?"
Cullens cut in, and he strode forward and laid a hand on Mr. Saxon Cove.
"Then I'm afraid you must release whomever this Mr. Echimarus says you've imprisoned. I might have to charge you for kidnapping if you didn't."
Saxon Cove was so shocked at this that he could say nothing. His mouth flapped like an angry fish, but wordlessly he pushed away the constable's hand and strode from the room. The Echimarus dove after him, and together we all trooped after them. I saw Heidegen handing Phelps a roll of clean white bandages with a knowing smile, and Phelps took them with a laugh and briskly wound his hands up as we walked. Mr. Saxon Cove's menagerie was somewhat larger than Lord Oakbridge's, and located in an atrium of the house with a domed glass ceiling. It was a very beautiful room, but frightfully cold and cramped from all the cages and pens, and unlike Lord Oakbridge's menagerie, this one still had all its occupants. Eyes of every shape and colour turned warily toward us as we entered, but as soon as the Echimarus stepped into the room, the air was filled with wild cawing, croaking and roaring. Wings flapped, claws scraped, and teeth snapped against metal bars. I saw a small griffin hanging off the mesh of its cage front, trying to reach its front claw through one of the holes, reaching for the Echimarus almost beseechingly. A large golden bird, the size of an eagle, with a crimson plume of feathers on its head, hopped from perch to perch in its cage, shrieking, and below it a blue monkey-like creature was crying in a fearfully good imitation of a child. The noise was such that Heidegen and Cullens both covered their ears, and Mr. Saxon Cove looked utterly taken aback. But the Echimarus paid the clamouring prisoners no heed, and walked purposefully through the ruckus until it came to a set of cages stacked against the far wall. There it stopped and looked meaningfully over its shoulder at us. Standing beside it, Phelps beckoned to Saxon Cove, but the man was too distracted by the uproar to notice, so I took him gently by the arm and led him down the aisle to where Phelps and the Echimarus were waiting. Phelps pointed at a cage on the ground row, where two white rabbits sat huddled together, looking miserable and ordinary. But when Mr. Saxon Cove came forward reluctantly to let them out, the Echimarus growled and lowered its head. Phelps glanced at it in some surprise, but then he shrugged and turned to me.
"It asks that you be the one to release them," he said,
and stood back to let me through.
I came forward warily, as the Echimarus's head, and thus its horns, were pointed in my direction. But it merely watched me intently as I knelt down, drew back the latch, and opened the door for the little rabbits. For a moment they seemed not to believe the door was actually open. They perked up their long white ears and twitched their little pink noses, and then finally they half walked, half hopped, out of the cage. The second one paused at my feet, sat up on its haunches, and looked at me with thoughtful brown eyes.
"How kind. Thank you," it said in a small, soft voice.
I was surprised, but not enough to forget my manners. "You are very welcome," I said, watching it hop after its companion to where the Echimarus was standing, its nose almost touching the ground. The three conversed silently, apparently unaware of Cullens and Heidegger, who had caught up at last and were staring at them in amazement. At length the rabbits turned away and hopped over to Mr. Saxon Cove, who stared down at them in surprise.
"We are grateful for our release," they said in unison with their soft little voices. "But we would much rather our friends and kin be set free as well."
Mr. Saxon Cove gaped at them for several moments, apparently at a loss for words. When he still did nothing, the Echimarus raised its head and growled. The man jumped, and looked from the innocent little rabbits to the fearsome creature and back again.
"Are you threatening me?"
he said in a choked voice.
"This is daylight robbery."
"I think not," Phelps said, leaning over his shoulder.
"To them, it is simply justice. How would you like to be shut up in a cage against your will? But consider this. Luck rabbits have immense power for good. If you grant their wishes, I have no doubt they will reward you handsomely."
Mr. Saxon Cove looked properly torn at this prospect. He rocked from foot to foot, staring around at his motley audience. Then, to my surprise, he let out a great sigh of defeat and got out his keys. Slowly, as if he himself could not believe what was happening, he went from cage to cage and began unlatching and unlocking the many, many doors. Their occupants, most likely too stunned or too frightened to move, stayed inside until he had passed on to the next set, and then followed at a safe distance. All the while the little white rabbits hopped at Mr. Saxon Cove's heels, as proud as if they themselves were liberating their companions. The Echimarus, long and lean and gaunt, paced beside them, sometimes snorting or pawing at the ground whenever Mr. Saxon Cove hesitated. Behind him, the procession of odd animals walked, slithered, hopped and fluttered, as if he were some mad incarnation of the Pied Piper. When all was finally finished, and we stood beside the door to the house, the Luck Rabbits gave us one last thoughtful look, and then hopped over the threshold and vanished. One by one they were followed by every animal in the menagerie, save the Echimarus, which stood guard at Mr. Saxon Cove's shoulder until the last fluorescent orange toad had crawled through the door and vanished as well. Then it finally moved to leave us, but Cullen surged forward at the last moment, his hand outstretched as though to apprehend it.
"Wait! There is still the matter of Lord Oakbridge's death!"
he began, but was stopped by Phelps, who had grabbed him by the shoulder.
"Please, friend," said he, "do not mar your record of intelligence with this blunder. I fear that creature is beyond the reach of mortal law. To attempt to bring it to justice would be like bringing a storm or an avalanche to justice. Better to let it go."
Cullens looked like he would have dearly liked to argue this point, but by then the Echimarus had made it to the door. It gave us a flick of its lion's tail, and then it was gone.
"Well," said Heidegger with a pleased sigh, "I believe that is that."
He was interrupted by a shout from Mr. Saxon Cove, and together we turned to find the gentleman on his knees on the cold ground, where a small mountain of gold nuggets had appeared.
"I say,"
he cried, scooping up a handful,
"this is most handsome indeed. Why, this is quite enough to start a new collection."
I turned to Phelps, who rolled his eyes heavenward and sighed. The Ecumarus's work is never finished, Heidegger remarked ruefully and led the way back into the house.
What am I going to tell the inspectrix?
Cullens groaned as we were shown to the door.
That I had the murderer in hand, but that it was some sort of strange, twisted unicorn, and I had to let it go. Even if she believes me, she'll have my hide.
On the contrary, my fine fellow, Phelps said reassuringly, I believe Inspectrix Enstrid will be all understanding and sympathy. This statement drew incredulous looks from all three of us, and Heidegger opened his mouth to protest, but Phelps raised a hand to silence him.
No,
said he as we made our way down the front steps and through the garden.
I have a very strong feeling that the good Inspectrix has more than a little experience with magic and magical crimes. After all, finding your murderer to be an unarrestable, fantastical creature walking on behalf of a pair of rabbits is... Oh, what word did the Inspectrix use? It was so wonderfully succinct.
Hocus pocus, sir, I said.
Yes, hocus pocus, exactly. Thank you, Corianne. Tell her it was all hocus pocus, poppycock, and moonshine. I am sure she will understand completely.
He patted Cullens gingerly on the shoulder with one bandaged hand, and then, resting his cane on his own shoulder, marched down to the road, whistling.
Is he always this infuriating?
The constable asked me. I glanced uncertainly at Phelps's tall, purple-clad form and shrugged. But then I caught Heidegger's eye and saw there a knowing twinkle. He winked.
Yes, I said, and could not stop the smile that was slowly growing on my face. Yes, I'm afraid he is.
The end. I once heard a story about Harlan Ellison, the famous writer, how he was once approached by a fan who said she had put him in a story she wrote as an elf. Mr. Ellison responded, as I recall, in a typical scathing sort of way, but what really made me wince was the elf part. Read anything about Mr. Harlan Ellison, and it's clear that, if he should be put in a story, it should be as some sort of troll, or maybe a very bitter wizard. I took this to heart in the creation of the character of Heidegger, who is himself loosely based on a different famous writer. Who this writer is, I leave up to the audience to deduce, since I think I've left enough clues that his fans should be able to recognize him. His voice aside, since I'm afraid I mangled his accent somewhat. Let us just say that it is no accident that Heidegger, despite being a perfectly cheerful, friendly person, is a professional necromancer. The Ecumarus, on the other hand, is based on no real person, but rather those particular horses I have met who have displayed more ferocity, malevolence, and tendency to violence than their carnivorous counterparts ever have. Now, for anyone interested in reading more about Beau Ragnar Phelps, you can find this and all of his adventures available as ebooks the world over in the Amazon Kindle, Barnes & Noble Nook, and the iTunes iBook Store. For easy access, you can find a complete catalog of my work on my own website at goldeneogawa.com/books. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in, or download, or whatever, listen, at the very least, next week, when I'll be reading the 8th Beau Ragnar Phelps story, The Song of the Firestones. And if you would like to discuss famous people and what sort of creature they would be if you stuck them in a fantasy book, feel free to email me at goldeneogawa, that's goldeneogawa@gmail.com, or
You can tweet me at GrimbyTweets. And also, I am on Goodreads. Search for Goldine Ogawa or go directly to goodreads.com/GrimbyReads. And for easy to copy text versions of those URLs, please see the description that came attached to this podcast episode. That's all I got for this week. I hope you have enjoyed what it was. And as always, before I go, I'd just like to say, special thanks for their help in the production of Radio Grimbald go out to Marion Goldine, my wonderful mother, Evan Ogawa, and Rachel Goldine for creating the theme music, and of course to you for listening. Radio Grimbald is written, performed, edited, and just about everything else by me, Goldine Ogawa. Find out more on the web at radiogrimbald.com and goldineogawa.com. Thank you for listening, and until next week, take care and have fun. Thank you.